Today's Tay Show will be on case 48 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Kenpo's One Road. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, "It is written, Bhagavats in the 10 directions, one straight road to Nirvana. I am still wondering where the road can be." Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line, and said, "Here it is." Later, the monks asked the same question of Umon, who held up his fan and said, "This fan jumps up to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakra Devanam Indra. When you strike the carp of the eastern sea, the rain comes down in torrents." Mumon's comment: one, going to the bottom of the sea, lifts up clouds of dust. The other, on top of the highest mountain, raises towering waves to wash the sky. One holding fast, the other letting go. Each stretches out his hand to support the profound teaching. They are just like two riders starting from opposite ends of the course and meeting in the middle. But none on earth can be absolutely direct. When examined with a true eye, neither of these two great masters actually knows the road. Mumon's verse: before a step is taken, the goal is already reached. Before the tongue is moved, the speech is finished. Though each move is ahead of the next, there is still a transcendent secret. This is a little story about two different teachers and their response to a student, a monk. A monk first asked Kenpo Osho. Osho means like priest. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, "It's written, Bhagavats in the 10 directions, but one straight road to Nirvana. I wonder where the road can be." Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line, and said, "Here it is." So later, the monks asked the same question of Umon, different teacher, different style, who held up his fan and said, "This fan jumps up to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakra Devanam Indra. When you strike the carp of the eastern sea, the rain comes down in torrents." This is wonderful koan, I think, because it points to two different aspects of Zen practice. These aspects are probably always going to be present in our practice. Also, it's rather interesting that different traditions emphasize different aspects, these different aspects, to different degrees. You know, the other day I was sitting in Princeton. And one of the people in our Princeton group came up to me and said he had been reading a book by a Japanese master in the Rinzai tradition. Now, actually, my first teacher was a monk in the Rinzai tradition, teacher in the Rinzai tradition of Zen. Rinzai means Linji, the Linji tradition of Zen. And my second teacher also had received transmission in the Rinzai tradition of Zen, but had close ties with Soto, the other tradition. In Zen, we have these two traditions. One is called Soto, from Chinese Sao Tong, and the other is called Rinzai, from Chinese Linji. This person from the Princeton group had been reading this book by a master named Omori Sogen. And he came up to me with some enthusiasm. And he said, "You know, I've been reading this very interesting book by Omori Sogen, and I had to laugh because I know about Omori Sogen. And he said, you know, reading this book makes me realize how different our style of practice is from many other Zen centers. He said that, you know, I've read a lot of books on Zen, and they tend to emphasize certain aspects of practice. But when I read this book, I realized we emphasize a very different style of practice. And then he said, I realized that most of these other teachers are from the Soto tradition. And this is the first time I've read anything by a teacher in the Rinzai tradition. But I really see that there's a great difference in emphasis. And I was, you know, I agree. There, you know, there's some differences between Soto and Rinzai Zen. And perhaps this is a good occasion for me just to say a little something about that, that you might be interested in. First of all, let me say that Soto Zen is 100% real Zen. So there's no question here that one tradition is superior to or better than the other. Just as Tibetan Buddhism is 100% real Buddhism, you know. And Zen is not better or worse than the Tibetan path, or not better or worse than Theravada path. These are all traditions of practice that have evolved in different places at different times. And they have different methods, different emphases, and maybe you could say different, they use different medicines to cure different kinds of illnesses. Now in the past, it was the case that if you were practicing in Thailand, you had to study Vipassana, basically, because that was all there was. And if you were practicing in Kyoto, it was Zen, or it was pure land, or maybe Shingon. If you were in Tibet, you were pretty much stuck with Tibetan Buddhism. But now, you know, we're in the enviable situation where people can go to the local Zen center, or they can go to the local Tibetan center, or they can go to the local Vipassana center, and they can try it out and they can find out which of these traditions is most congenial to them, which is most helpful to them, and so on. And I think what's eventually going to happen, and it's already happening, is that people in the Tibetan tradition are having conversations with people in the Zen tradition and people in the Theravada tradition, and all learning from each other. So this is a wonderful, wonderful moment historically in the history of Buddhist meditation. Because all of these different traditions have deep underlying similarities, but they've all explored different aspects of practice and reality. And they are now in a position to talk to one another intelligently. And I think that's wonderful. I'm really excited about this. And the only danger, it seems to me, is that you know, sectarianism will raise its ugly head. So you will sometimes hear people say, you know, well, you know, that's not real Buddhism, or that's not real Zen. And you should not listen to that. You know, I've actually met monks who were quite sectarian in their outlook. Even my first teacher, Genki Roshi, though I love him dearly, was quite sectarian, and in a very bad way. When Genki Roshi first came to the United States, Webb, his sensei, would translate his Taisho. And Genki Roshi would say things in Japanese that Webb did not want to translate. You know, this happened all the time, as a matter of fact. And sometimes, Genki's English wasn't always good enough at first to pick up on what Webb was and wasn't saying. So for one thing, Genki Roshi was very salty in his language. You know, so he might say somebody was a blockhead, And then Webb would say, well, he wasn't very observant, or something like that, you know. So that would go on all the time. But another one, there would be moments like this where there's a story in Zen tradition in Japan about a famous general who had to fight a battle against the Mongols were going to invade Japan. After the Mongols conquered China, they were going to go on and take over. They went into Burma. They went and wrecked a big city in Burma, the major capital of Burma. They were unstoppable, and they were going to attack Japan, and they launched a huge armada against Japan. And fortunately, the Japanese were able to repel them with the help of a terrible storm that blew the many of the Mongol ships onto rocks. But at any rate, this general was waiting for the battle, and he knew it was like do or die, that basically if the Mongols took over, that was the end of Japanese civilization. And so while he did some meditation, while he was doing meditation, he had a deep Kensho experience in which everything, he was looking at the water, but he suddenly realized the water had become absolutely motionless and was hanging in space. So he had this deep Kensho experience. So anyway, Genki Roshi told the story like this. After his Kensho experience, he didn't know what had happened to him, so he went to the local temple. And unfortunately, it was a Soto temple. And of course, they don't know anything about enlightenment there. Right? This is what Genki Roshi said. And he said, so then he went to the Rinzai temple and, you know, found Hakuin Zenji. You know, and Hakuin Zenji said, oh, this is... So this is really terrible. Right? So this actually happened. So Webb translated this in a completely different way. He just said he went to the temple, but the monk there didn't know anything, and then he went to meet Hakuin Zenji. So, you know, I was exposed to this kind of sectarian rivalry, and I thought Genki Roshi was a deeply awakened person, but he had some karmic residue, right? After your Daikensho, you still have a personal history. And if you're not very careful, you don't clean up all your karma. So he had karma to clean up in the area of sectarian prejudice, I would say. So let me just go on record as assuring you that both of these traditions are valid. They have a little different emphasis. And you know, my understanding is that the Soto approach is to, in some ways, formalize and complicate. So, for example, in the Soto tradition, posture is extremely important. Not just sitting straight on the cushion, but sitting perfectly on the cushion. So, Soto training makes quite a big deal out of perfect posture. And I had the chance to study for a while with a Soto teacher. His name was Hirano Katsufumi Osho-san. He was the head of training at Eheiji Temple, which is the major Soto temple. And his style was to emphasize immaculate posture. And he would go around at every sit and correct everybody's posture. And he would say, you know, when you sit, you have to be Buddha. So your posture has to be perfect. If your posture is perfect, your mind will be perfect. See, this is very a Soto approach. Soto robes are a little more complicated, in my opinion, than Rinzai robes. And getting the robes folded properly is quite important. Getting the sash called the kesa, folding the kesa properly is quite important. And the formalism of going through this process of sitting properly, arranging the robe properly, etc., etc., all of this is highly emphasized. See, highly emphasized. And this is a way of getting people to pay attention to the moment. Another example of this is if you've ever had a chance to go to a Zen mountain monastery and go through a meal there, you'll notice that they eat in a very different way from the way we eat. At least I myself have never been there, but when I have been at Soto establishments, you know, they have more bowls than we do, and they take longer to eat, and there's a more complicated ritual. And this is generally the case. So you have more bowls, and you have a complicated ritual, and probably as you're doing the ritual, you're going to try to get it right, but you're going to make some mistakes, see? And the mistakes are going to make you tense, see? And then as you get tense, you're going to have to focus, and then you'll make another mistake, and it might go downhill, but little by little, you'll get through this whole thing, this whole ritual. And at the same time, your concentration is going to become quite sharp. So, you know, my understanding might be quite wrong, but my feeling about Soto is that it puts a great deal of emphasis on complicating simple things to make people pay attention. And this is a wonderful strategy. Wonderful strategy. Complicating simple things to make people pay attention. And it's funny, you know, if you try to do something simple in a mindful way, it becomes harder to do. Isn't that interesting? So if you're going to button your shirt and you make a big deal out of it mentally, you say, I've got to make sure this is just right. Right? Or if some of you some people still wear ties, like around your neck. I myself wear a tie like once a year. If I can help it, I never wear one. My father showed me how to tie one, and when I tie my tie, every time I think about what my dad told me to do, right? And if I want it to look good, it never looks right, you know? So basically, I'll tie it, but it'll be too short, see? So then I have to untie it and let a little more slack into the tie, back it up, and then tie it again, and then it's too long. It's below the belt buckle. So then you untie it, and it's finally right, but then you notice the knot is too thin, you know, and it looks kind of a sickly little knot. So then you do the tie, and you loop it around the two sides, and you get a nice thick knot, but then it's too short again, see? Now, if this is this kind of a thing is in the context of Zen practice, right, where it's supposed to be meditation, and it's supposed to be sacred, and you're doing it with other people, and they're looking at you, and the teacher is looking at you. Your ability to do this is supposed to show your state of mind. See, this creates great stress, and also great attentiveness. So there's a kind of pressure that builds up in Soto practice between the desire to get this right and the complication of the task. And that pressure is actually very productive. If you've ever read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, beautiful book. It's a beautiful book. But there's a kind of a subtle trap in that book you might not notice, but it's very typical of Soto teaching. You know, he's constantly describing how you should feel on the cushion. So when we sit on the cushion, this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. But of course, if you sit on the cushion, none of those things are going to happen, right? Because your mind won't be in the moment, it'll be distracted. You know, you won't be able to focus on things, you know, they do a practice called shikantaza, or just watching the moment. But actually it's very, very difficult to just watch the moment. When you try, you know, all of these thoughts, all of these concerns and anxieties wash over you. So it becomes very difficult just to be in the moment. In fact, the more you tell somebody be in the moment, the more difficult it becomes. This is really interesting, isn't it? And this practice is very much the essence of Soto practice. So Soto, I think, complicates simple things, and it forces people to cultivate deep attentiveness to the moment and enter deep samadhi. It's a brilliant strategy. I may be wrong, but this is my impression from the Soto teachers I have trained with. You know, Rinzai's style, in my opinion, and again, I could be wrong, this is just one person's understanding of Rinzai tradition, is rather different in its emphasis. See, If you have had the chance to come to Sesshin with our group, you know that eating is a relatively simple affair, right? We have three bowls, we have a bowl cover, we have some chopsticks, okay? There's not a lot of, it's not really too complicated, right? Once you get the hang of it, the secret is, I'll tell you the secret. The rice goes in the big bowl, okay? Some vegetables go in the middle bowl, and some vegetables go in the little bowl. The other secret is don't eat your pickle till the end because you have to use it to clean your bowl, see? Now see, this is like the Rinzai approach, right? This is the Rinzai approach. Simplify everything. See, I think the Soto approach is complicate the simple things. And the Rinzai approach is simplify complicated things. This is I think, really like the essential difference. And it really depends on your temperament. You know, it really depends on your temperament, which of these you find more congenial. It is said that Soto Zen was, in Japan, the Zen of mostly farming communities. So I often think that the people who went to sit in Soto temples were like farmers. They didn't have much of formal education, didn't have a lot of etiquette, instruction in etiquette. You know, so they came to a temple, it was like going to graduate school or going to the university, very high class. They were always trying to fit in and feel that they were really belonging. So, you know, this ritualism and this formalism put a great deal of pressure on them to enter deep concentration. And it was appropriate for them. Now, in Japan, the people who tended to go into Rinzai were aristocrats and intellectuals, right? And aristocrats I'm not particularly fond of, you know, never having been one, you know. You know, they have everything, right? They don't worry about good manners. They know how many forks you're supposed to have at a banquet. They know that this fork is for this and this fork. So aristocrats don't really worry about doing things right. They've always done things right. Their problem is they want to simplify. Right. So Rinzai Zen was like a breath of fresh air because it said you don't have to have eight bowls. You can have three. You can have one. Just eat your rice and be natural. See, and for people who have such a hard time being natural, that was like heaven, right? Same thing with intellectuals, right? I mean, if you've read lots of books, you know the limits of reading books. So if a Zen teacher says, "Listen, there's no truth in books," it can be so liberating, right? It's like, "Oh, I knew it," because I've read so many, you know, and I'm still stuck, right? So it's like, no, finally. So this is sort of the difference in the two traditions. I think that Soto complicates simple things, and I think Rinzai takes simple things, complicated things and makes them simple. And this is like basic difference between the two. So, our style of practice is quite a bit different from what you'd see in a Soto establishment. We don't worry so much about posture. So, you know, in our temple, Genki Roshi, let me just say, when I practiced with this man, Hirano Katsufumi, he hit me with the stick almost all the time, right? I should explain that in Zen temples, there's a stick usually on the altar. And at the beginning of every sit, there's a man called the Jiki Jitsu. And he's like the posture cop, okay? And he goes up and down the aisles, and if you move even a little bit, wham, wham, right? And basically your posture has to be perfect. Well, you know, Genki Roshi, Hirano Osho-san hit me every day, and my posture was always terrible, and he always would come over and yell at me. This is why I didn't study with him, of course, you know. He would always yell at me, say, "Straighten the back!" Because, you know, I was always so hunched over. You know, I was in a lot of pain. It was hard for me. I couldn't straighten my back for about 5 years, really and truly, maybe longer. So I would sit there with a humped over back and, you know, just try to get through the sit. And then I could hear him get up. I could hear his robes rustling, you know, and he'd be swishing over to yell at me, and he'd yell at me, and then he'd hit me with a stick. So I thought, maybe this isn't my teacher, you know. So then I ran into Genki Roshi. And when I sat with Genki Roshi, style was very different. You know, he did actually go up and down the aisles. He would straighten you a little bit sometimes, but mostly he just left you alone. You know, and the interesting thing was you worked it out on your own. He never got on me about straightening the back, actually. You know, my first teacher was constantly yelling at me about this, and my second teacher was just, Genki hardly mentioned it. You know, Genki would generally just be very supportive. You know, when I would go into Dokusan and I would say, you know, my legs are killing me, he'd just say, well, you know, you're doing a good job, you know, hang in there, something, you know. And, you know, he was just very supportive. And, you know, little by little, my posture just got better. It just got better. And actually, today I have a sort of decent posture. I don't have the best posture in the room, but I have pretty good posture. Probably you've noticed there's a couple people in this room who, you know, have impeccable posture, and they often sit full lotus, and it's pretty awe-inspiring. Fortunately, you know, I'm over here in the shadows, and nobody can see my posture's not as good. But it's okay, right? And the interesting thing was it just naturally got better. I swear to you, it naturally got better. See, this is sort of the essence of the Rinzai style. Rinzai style sort of said, you know, actually Master Rinzai, Master Linji in China, was famous for telling people, don't try, don't try. He'd say, you know, in any situation, just don't try. And you'll be the master of any situation. It's, as soon as you try, you're already cutting yourself in two. See, just be with the situation. Just don't try. It's actually very hard work not to try, right? But that's the essence of the, as I understand Rinzai Zen, that's the essence of the style of Rinzai practice. You know, and I think there's something Rinzai used to say, don't try. He also used to say all the time, just be natural. Just be natural. See, it's hard to just be natural. You know, you sit on the cushion and you think, okay, I'm just going to be natural, right? Then your legs start to hurt. So does being natural mean you uncross your legs? Because pretty soon you'll be uncrossing your legs every 5 seconds, right? Or you'll be shifting around. That doesn't feel so natural, right? So what it means to be natural is rather complicated. But Rinzai was saying, just be natural. This is the essence of the Rinzai tradition. See? And my feeling is that if you just keep practicing, and you have to show up, sit on the cushion, and just be present, right, in a kind of spirit of acceptance, you know, and stop trying to accomplish something, and all kinds of wonderful things happen to you. You know, for about 6 years, it was not only hard for me to straighten my back, it was very hard for me to sit for more than half an hour. And I would have pain in my legs. You know what that's like. You know, I would have pain in my knees. That would go away, and I would have pain in my hips. I would have pain in my calves. I don't know if you've ever had a Charlie horse. You know what a muscle cramp is? You know, a Charlie horse, when you're sitting, it's like, yow! You know. So I used to get Charlie horses in my legs in the middle of a sit, right? And I would just feel like, you know, jumping up, you know, and screaming. So this would go on for about 6 years, you know, and every sit was like a race. You know, I'd be sitting there thinking, ring the bell, ring the bell. It really did happen one day that I was sitting on the cushion at a sesshin, And the bell rang, and I suddenly realized I don't feel like stopping. You know, I just didn't. I suddenly realized, you know, I'm really actually rather comfortable right now. And I'm just going to keep going. And I just kept going. And it was like amazing. Because I thought, you know, do I dare to do it? But I felt like, it was just, I felt, you know, I feel like doing it. I'll give it a try. You know, the bell rang once and that broke the sit. And then I thought, should I move? I don't feel like moving. I'll just stay here for a while. Watching the breath. Moo. Calling moo. Then, you know, four rings and I think, now I've done it. Now I'm stuck. You know, but I didn't feel that bad. You know, 30 minutes went like that. The bell rang. I did it. You know, the next time I sat down on the cushion, I thought, okay, you know, pain is conquered. It didn't happen, right? And I thought, I'm going to go through this one too, you know. So like 15 minutes in, my legs are killing me, you know, and I sort of crumbled. The bell rings. Okay, I uncrossed my legs. But, you know, it did happen again. During that same sesshin, I realized, you know, I'm not going to move again. And I just coasted through the next sit. It's just as natural as a leaf blowing on the water. I just went right to, it was totally natural. You know, you have to show up. You have to be present. You have to come to the sit. You have to come to the sesshin. And, you know, you do. You struggle. But all of a sudden, you're in the groove, you know, you're in the flow, and you feel 100% natural. It's like, this is where I should be, this is the moment I should be in, you know, and I just coasted across that sit. You know, just, I didn't try, I just realized I can do it. It was like part of me just said, go ahead, you're ready, and I did it, you know. This is sort of what Rinzai means. You know, if you get into Zen with a timetable, you know, there's a, you know, I used to have a friend who used to talk to me all the time about how unhappy he was that he wasn't making progress. And he was talking to me, and I was like the worst Zen student in our group, you know. He would come to me and say, you know, I haven't answered a koan in 4 months. And I would be thinking, I haven't answered a koan, period, you know. And he had like a timetable. It's like, I've got to get this done by X number of years. And he actually created a lot of pressure for himself. I don't know if he ever finished his training or not, but he had a powerful desire to be a great Zen master. You know, he would read all of these stories about the great Zen masters, and he set out to be a great Zen master. And indeed, he could sit for long periods of time, but I don't think he was very happy in his practice. And I think he misunderstood Zen training very much. This is I've talked about this person before. He's the one who told me he liked Dokusan. I said, you do? Because I hated Dokusan for a long time. Genki Roshi was a very sweet man, but I hated to go in there and not have anything to present, right? So, you know, I was working on the Mu koan. I was sitting there calling Mu all day. And I would go into Genki. I just felt, oh no, not Dokusan. You know, and I would, you know, I just go in there and I feel basically kind of ashamed that I let him down. You know, it's like I let him down again. I didn't have anything to present. So Dokusan was like a torture for me. So this guy said, I'd love to go into Dokusan. And I said, really? He said, oh yeah, I love to match wits with the Roshi. It's like, oh. Wait, is that so? Maybe I should be matching wits with the Roshi. I don't know what that. So, wrong spirit, in my opinion. See, wrong spirit, in my opinion. You know, if you go to a sesshin saying, I'm going to answer my koan, it's a pretty sure bet you're not going to answer your koan, in my opinion. And if you say, I'm going to finish Zen training in 9.5 years, Dai Kensho is 9, and then half a year to clean up my karma. you can bet, it's not going to happen. You know, that's the worst way to practice. You know, so The best way to practice, in my experience, is, and maybe this is why I find the Rinzai approach so congenial, is to just let it happen naturally. Let it happen naturally. So you come in, it's a Saturday, first Saturday after our sesshin. You come in, you sit down, you know, and it's not easy to be natural because we have all of these expectations. You sit on the cushion and think, I'm going to sit, have a wonderful sit, it's going to be deep, my face and arms are going to disappear, the electricity is going to flow, you know. Then you sit down on the cushion, there's pain in your legs, your stomach is grumbling, you know, your back hurts, maybe you have a sore throat from allergies, you know, this is not what I ordered. Right? So, learning how to be natural means this is okay, right? This is it today. This is Buddha today. So what am I going to do with this? How am I going to embrace this? See, this is Buddha today. And it's very difficult for us to embrace the things we hate or to embrace physical pain, you know, that's very difficult. But actually, it's natural for your legs to be in pain sometimes. They get tired, right? Your legs get tired. You know, if you think the Dalai Lama sits down for 4 hours a day and doesn't have tired legs, you're deluding yourself. You know, everybody who goes to sesshin has tired legs. The muscle, it's simple physiology. Of course, I don't understand it, but I know it's real. You know, your muscles produce acids, and that causes that burning sensation. There's nothing you can do about it. You can move, or you can be natural, right? You can become natural. Natural means this is my true self today, right? This is my true, there is, another way to put it is, there is no problem here. See, it's just I think there's a problem here. There is never any problem here. See, if we ever have our own temple, I think I would have on the door, usually in a car, there's usually some motto above the door in a temple. I think maybe we should have the no problem here. See, no, or something like that. Maybe, that might not be the right one, but you know, something like that. No problem here. Because that's what it means to be natural. My legs hurt, no problem here. My back hurts, no, I'm tired, I didn't get enough sleep, there's no problem here. See, that's the essence of the Rinzai approach. Essence of the Rinzai approach. So in this little koan, we have two different approaches, which are both really equally true, and it's sort of the difference between Rinzai and Soto. See, a monk said to Kenpo Osho, "It's written in the sutra, Bhagavats or enlightened beings in the 10 directions, but one straight road to Nirvana." I wonder, where is that road? And Kenpo is sort of a Rinzai guy. He draws a line in the dirt and he says, it's right where the road is right where you're standing. See, just be natural. You know, of course, most people think this is not where I want to be, right? Here is never where I want to be. You know, I mean, people get into Zen in a way because here is not where they want to be. And Zen is like a medicine, right? It's like a moksha medicine, learning to be where you are and being natural, right? Okay, so this is sort of like Rinzai approach. Just be natural, don't try. Okay, now Ulmon has kind of a little bit, I think, of a Soto approach. He says, he doesn't draw a line in the dirt and say it's right where you are. He says, this fan goes up to the highest heaven. You know, if you want to wake up, you have to follow this fan up to the highest heaven. Very remote, very difficult, very inaccessible. You know, you have to follow that fan up and it will hit Sakra Devanam Indra on the nose. Very difficult to achieve. Very remote from you. See, highest heaven. When you strike the carp of the eastern sea, it comes down in torrents. Now, this is like beyond human capability, but give it a try. you know, give it a try all the same. You know, try to go with the fan up to highest heaven, right? And of course, both of these are effective, right? Because it's actually very hard to be natural. To say, go ahead, accept where you are, accept your pain. Just be one with it, please. Be natural. And eventually it does happen. You know, one day you're sitting on the cushion and your legs hurt and your back aches and your stomach is empty and you say, you know, I just love this life. I love this moment with my whole heart. You know, and suddenly you realize you're in the flow. You're in the flow. See, that's wonderful. And then, you know, the other approach is the person who's trying to get to the 33rd heaven. And straining and straining and straining and straining, and then realizes, my God, this is the 33rd heaven, right here. See? So these are like two different approaches to the same understanding, same moment, same goal. And so both of them have their merits. Both of them have their pluses and both of them have their minuses. You know, some people need to complicate their lives. You know, they need that complication. They need to believe it's in the 33rd heaven, far from us. You know, there's a certain kind of person who really loves that, in that, because feels so unhappy with the moment. Can't imagine, this is not heaven, this is hell. Get me out of hell. And so there's a certain teaching that says, okay, sure, I'll get you out of hell. Heaven is far away, but, you know, let's start walking, brother, you know, okay? And that's a beautiful teaching. But there's the other style, which is sort of the Rinzai style, which says, there's no hell. Who told you there was a hell? That's not true. Heaven is always right here. Whatever's right here is always heaven. So try to be in heaven, but don't try. So. Little different style. But, you know, my feeling is that our approach is quite effective. You know, in Japan, the truth is that most people always felt that the Rinzai style was the style that had the deepest practice. Generally speaking, that was felt to be true. In fact, I've even heard that from Soto teachers who would say that in periods of decline in Zen in Japan, it was always the Rinzai masters who kept it together. See, and that is, I think, widely believed. That might be another story my teachers told me, because they were Rinzai partisans or something. But I've actually heard that. I actually have heard that rather widely. That, you know, basically the deepest practice was often the Rinzai practice. And of course, the koan tradition has been adopted by Soto Zen, but really was Rinzai innovation, came out of China. So the Soto tradition is really based upon silent illumination. Rinzai tradition is based upon koan training, a little different. So Rinzai tradition gives you puts you squarely in a contradiction. What is the sound of one hand clapping? Show me your face before your parents were born. And so on and so on. Right. What is the sound of no sound? And so you're in the middle of a terrible contradiction. Every part of your being wants to resolve the contradiction, right? Intellectually you want to resolve it. Even your body doesn't like a contradiction, right? Nobody likes being pulled in two directions at once. The more you work with your koan, the more torn apart you can feel. But at the same time, you know, there's Master Rinzai saying, hey, be natural, simplify, don't try. So kind of an interesting predicament. This is the essence of Rinzai practice, right? You're in the middle of a contradiction, you want to escape, you want to resolve it, and the teacher is saying, don't try to resolve it, just be natural. And actually, the natural world is inherently contradictory, isn't it? I mean, human beings try to separate dark from light and high from low. They try to separate love from hate. They try to separate health from illness. right? But we know you can't separate that. That's only the discriminating mind. In the natural world, you're always a little bit sick and a little bit healthy. That's how we really are, you know? So reality is inherently contradictory. And, you know, the secret of Zen, the secret of Rinzai Zen is the more you embrace the contradiction, the more alive you become, see? So, you know, just be with the contradiction and this wonderful, wonderful energy begins to fill your body. But you can't make it happen. You just have to internalize the contradiction. See, so actually it is true. If you try to solve your koan, you can't possibly solve your koan. Can't be solved. Every time you try to solve the koan, you just screw yourself up more fully. I mean, the way to practice Zen is to just sit on the cushion, become one with the koan, and then patiently wait. You know, and one day, it's like an acorn growing into a tree. You know, the acorn doesn't plan to be a tree, or it might. You know, and maybe it worries the whole time. You know, what am I going to be a tree? You know, or am I going to be a dog? You know, I could be, what, grass, you know, and worry about it, or maybe it has aspirations. You know, maybe it wants to be a beech tree, but it's already an oak, you know. Little water, time, in the readiness of time, acorns become mighty oak tree. So, you know, this is our practice, this is the essence of our practice. The koan is a contradiction. If you try to solve it, you never solve it. So what do you do with the koan? You become one with the contradiction. This is like becoming one with nature itself. And as this happens, you grow into a mighty tree of awakening. And this is how we do it. This is how we do it in over here in this tradition. But you know, I think this is a great way to practice. Because it's like, you know, being natural is a great way to live. You know, just the truth is, you know, that we are not trying to become enlightened. And Master Linji always used to say this, you know, it's not the case that you came here to become enlightened. Your enlightened self told you to come here. And all you have to do is get straight with your enlightened self, see? You have to find a way to live with your enlightened self, your true self. Your true self says, get up on Saturday morning and come to sit, you know, at 7 in the morning or 9:30 in the morning. And it doesn't feel very natural, you know, but if you do it, you know, you suddenly feel so alive, so wonderful. So it's not true that you came here to become enlightened. That's never what we're really trying to do. What we're trying to do is to serve our enlightened self, is to be open to our enlightened self, which is already giving us instructions. We're just too unnatural to receive them sometimes, right? Unnatural self says it's not natural to get up at 4:30 in the morning at Sesshin, but you know, when you do it for 3 days, your mind becomes as clear as glass. You know, and suddenly, you know, it's a beautiful world. So which is the more natural way to live? Kenpo's One Road. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, it is written, Bhagavats in the 10 directions, but one road to nirvana. I still wonder where that road can be. Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line, and said, it's right here. Just be natural. Just be natural. Later, the monks asked the same question of Umon, who held up his fan and said, this fan jumps up to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakra Devanam Indra. When you strike the carp of the eastern sea, the rain comes down in torrents. Mumon's comment. One, going to the bottom of the sea lifts up clouds of dust. The other, on the top of the highest mountain, raises towering waves to wash the sky. One holds fast, the other lets go. Each strikes out his hand to support the profound teaching. Both are true. These are different roads to the same path. They are just like two riders starting from opposite ends of the course and meeting in the middle. But none on earth can be absolutely direct. When examined with the true eye, neither of these two great masters knows the road. Remember, when Mumon says something like this, he's paying a compliment. So when he says both of them are blockheads, he means both of them are enlightened. Okay, neither knows the way means they know the way. Okay. Mumon's verse. Before a step is taken, the goal is reached. Your true self already gave you the order to come here. So you're not trying to become your true self. Already told you to come. And when you came, you became natural. See? Before a step is taken, the goal is already reached. Before the tongue is moved, the speech is already finished. Though each move is ahead of the next, there is still a transcendent secret. Well, that's the last part of this koan, and I hope you and I will have a chance to do this koan together, and I hope you can tell me the transcendent secret. Okay. But until then, the speech is finished. Thank you all very much for coming today.